Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, exploring ideas for improving government effectiveness with Professor Sanford Borens, author of the IBM Center Report, The Persistence of Innovation in Government. So, Sandy, while there have been significant changes in the landscape of American public sector innovation, a great many things remain constant, and particularly it's the process. You mentioned that innovation continues to originate at all organizational levels. Why is this the case, and what's the implication of such a finding?
Okay. For the 2010 semifinalists, as for those in the 1990s, roughly half the innovations were initiated by frontline public servants or middle managers. The original finding surprised researchers, myself included, because we thought that public sector organizations were too bureaucratic and risk-averse to permit much innovation coming from anywhere other than the top. The persistence of this finding in this decade is confirmation that what I first saw isn't an anomaly. The implication is that politicians and agency heads should find ways to support frontline innovation.
Sandy, what conditions prompt innovation? What is the contrast between crisis and problems as factors leading to innovation? And to what extent do problems lead to innovation more often than crises do?
Okay. The five factors I found in order of importance are problems, crises, opportunities, political pressure, and new leadership. The surprise in my finding from the 1990s, and that was also the case for the 2010 semifinalists, is that problems are more important than crises in prompting public sector innovation. Put differently, innovative public servants tend to be proactive problem solvers who come up with responses to problems before they escalate into crises. This is another repudiation of cynical views of the public sector. I would also add that if governments are producing good performance data, then the performance data would start to give alert public servants signals about when there are problems so that they can be proactive in responding.
So, Sandy, after considering the who and the why of initiating innovation, the next question is how. And your research identifies that innovators tend to be strategic planners rather than incremental gropers. Why is that the case, and what are the implications of this finding?
Okay. In both the 1990s and currently, I found a considerably higher proportion of innovators who developed and then implemented a plan for their innovation, planning, if you will, than of innovators who started with a vague idea and implemented it through trial and error, groping, if you will. Having a plan builds support, especially if a number of partner organizations are involved in the innovation. And indeed, the data show that there are more partnerships involved in innovations. Of course, having a plan doesn't mean being inflexible, because implementing any plan will require some adaptation. But my strong advice to any would-be public sector innovator would be to start with a plan.
Sandy, would you outline the key obstacles to innovation as well as tactics used to respond to these obstacles?
Okay. The key obstacles, in order of importance, are resistance within the bureaucracy, difficulty finding funding, and resistance outside the organization, either from the public or from politicians. The key tactics that the innovators use to overcome obstacles were persuasion, for example, showing an innovation's benefits, a demonstration project, or social marketing, and accommodation, for example, consultation, co-optation, or training the people whose work would be changed as a result of the innovation. The overall message here is that a great deal of opposition to innovations is motivated by concern about how they would affect work life within the public sector. And it's important for the innovator to take the opposition seriously and respond to it.
Sandy, along with your focus on public sector innovation, you have also been interested on the role of narrative and storytelling in public management. Would you tell us more about the main thesis of your other work, Governing Fables, Learning from Public Sector Narratives? What are the key insights from this work?
In Governing Fables, I was analyzing a variety of recently authored narratives, such as autobiographies and movies, in particular documentaries and docudramas. And I was trying to develop archetypal fables or stories in government. These fables deal with both a protagonist, usually a leader, and an organization. Examples of this are what I call the heroic fable, in which the leader and the organization both overcome adversity, and the ironic fable, in which the protagonist achieves his or her personal goals, but the organization ends up worse off. In the extreme, the ironic fable may be about corruption or kleptocracy. The book shows how the patterns of fables differ sharply in the U.S. and Great Britain. In general, the British are far more cynical than we are. The West Wing is as essentially American as Yes Minister is as essentially British. I also show how political campaigns invariably recreate these fables in their messaging. Effective campaigns tell a heroic story about their own candidate and an ironic story about their opponent. In this view, attack ads aren't a degradation of our political culture, but are intrinsic to campaigning. So these are some of the findings to come out of that book.
Sandy, as a follow-up, how have these two research interests, innovation and narrative, converged, and what are the benefits of their fusion?
Well, I suppose when I was doing it, I thought I was being, in some sense, bipolar, in that the innovation work was quantitative and the narrative work was qualitative work, and these were just sort of two separate and disjoint aspects of my intellectual personality. However, they converged in that I applied the analytical framework of my narrative work to uncover and to outline the structure of stories that public sector innovators tell. It's always rewarding if you realize that what you thought were two equally interesting but disparate streams of research actually have strong interrelationships.
Sandy, would you outline the archetypal innovation story that emerges from your research?
Okay, well, here's how I applied it to innovation. Reading enough of the applications, I imagined an archetypal innovation success story, and it would go something like this. The originality and effectiveness of the innovation were quickly realized. The innovation was promptly adopted, and the program grew rapidly. It was replicated widely, and the innovation and its originators received public recognition and awards. And that's pretty much of a heroic story. Okay, in contrast to this, you can imagine an archetypal innovation failure story that would go something like this. The innovation was launched and began to scale up, but it encountered so many problems, perhaps problems of poor organizational design or perverse incentives, that it sank under the weight of the problems and was terminated. Most innovation stories tend to fall somewhere in between the two poles, with the element of the story about overcoming resistance to change and with the actual impact of the innovation determining whether it will be closer to one pole or to the other.
So, Sandy, I find your research into public sector innovation and the use of narrative in public sector management very insightful. Would you illustrate the practical application of narrative in public sector management? How can these insights help government executives in their daily efforts?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the practical application would be to say to managers, here are the characteristics of a heroic narrative. Can you develop a heroic narrative about your organization or about the people who receive services from your organization? And these narratives can be a way of, as it were, marketing, advertising, raising public consciousness about the organization. Similarly, political parties do that in their advertising. If you watch a number of political ads from recent campaigns, and you start to think about them in terms of the structure of the stories, the structure can become very clear. The structure can become clear, and the sorts of emotions that they're trying to arouse in the viewer can become clear. What I'm doing in studying of narratives is looking at a lot of case studies or a lot of movies, and I'm looking for commonly repeated patterns in these case studies and movies. and, you know, the patterns deal with the structure of the particular stories. And my sort of heroic narratives and heroic fables and ironic fables are an example of that. And this is a type of research that's being done by sort of literary scholars and film scholars as well, in terms of understanding the patterns in particular stories, or what they would call the narrative arc, and in particular understanding different types of stories. In my classes, I show political commercials produced for Barack Obama and for Stephen Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada. And, you know, these are two politicians on opposite sides of the political spectrum. The commercials both start with, you know, a voice of doom narrator that says, 2008, greatest economic crisis we've ever faced, etc. And then the commercials construct a story about how the president in one case and the prime minister in another case sort of made the tough policy decisions that turned the country around economically and as a result deserves re-election. And, you know, as I said, I show these to the students, and there's a lot of laughter in the sense of, my God, we see an American president and a Canadian prime minister telling exactly the same story for exactly the same purpose. So that sort of makes a point about how these narratives can be generic and widely used. You know, so I think this is very practical stuff.
Sandy, as a follow-up, if your agenda is to tighten or lessen the public sector footprint, then wouldn't that require leaders to be more innovative, or at least open to innovative approaches?
Okay. The federal government of Canada is a conservative government that has focused on trying to get government to do less. And as a consequence, you wouldn't think it has been innovative in too many ways. But interestingly, there is one area in which it has been innovative, and that area has been using tax credits to encourage desirable behavior on the part of citizens. Two examples that have been sort of quite successful were what was called a home renovation tax credit that was done for 1 year as part of the response to the global financial crisis. And basically, it gave people a tax credit of up to $1,500 for undertaking home renovations. And it turned out that one-third of all Canadian homeowners took advantage of that, which if you think about it, is tremendous take-up for a one-year program. The second example is what they've called the Registered Disability Savings Plan. And what that is basically what would be called, in U.S. terminology, an IRA, that parents of children with disabilities have been able to establish so as to accumulate money tax-free that can be used to support their children who have disabilities in later life. And this has been sort of an successful program within Canada. I don't know of too many other countries that have replicated it, but I think there's certainly potential for replication there. Well, I mean, sometimes, put it this way, one of the classic ways to do that is to substitute in-person service for, or to substitute online service for in-person service. And sometimes that works, and sometimes that doesn't. Another aspect of making the footprint smaller is just to stop doing things. You know, again, in the Canadian case, one area where the government tried to substitute technology for in-person service is with the services provided by the Department of Veterans Affairs. And, you know, what that resulted in was tremendous protests on the part of 85-year-old veterans who were complaining about having, you know, offices where they could meet with caseworkers closed and told to go onto a website.
Sandy, perhaps you could tell us more about your career and background.
I'm based at the University of Toronto. That's where I teach, and the University of Toronto pays my salary. On the other hand, I do have a relationship with the Harvard Kennedy School. I'm a research fellow at the Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation, which is the part of the Kennedy School that supports the Innovation Awards. And, this relationship has meant that they've supported my research on innovation, and sort of I've been involved in contributing to their program. So I have a foot in both camps, as it were. And then let me say a little bit about my own research, in particular the stream of research in narrative, which I'm in a way, after completing a book on innovation, I'm now sort of turning back to the research stream on narratives. As far as governing fables goes, there's an increasing number of narratives about public sector decision making that can be analyzed in terms of the fables that I've outlined. And I see somewhere on the horizon a second edition of governing fables that will take into account many of the narratives that have been coming out in the last few years since I published the initial book, which was in 2011. I should also say that there's a small community of scholars who are studying public sector narrative, and hopefully this community of scholars will grow. My next book, by the way, is called Enterprising Fables. And here I'm analyzing fables associated with a variety of industries, in particular automobiles, information technology, and financial services. So you might say that I'm going from Roger and Me to The Social Network to Wall Street to map the structure of stories about businesses. So that's what I'm working on now, and I hope in a year or two or three to have that book coming out as well to serve as a counterpart to governing fables. Initially, I had thought I was going to do one book that would deal with both public and private sector narratives, and I realized that that would be a very long book, and so I decided to divide the project up to work on the public sector first and then turn to the private sector. And so that's what I'm doing.
How can a climate for innovation be created in public organizations? We'll find out when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, A Conversation with Authors, returns.